Hello, my name is Thomas. Welcome to British Culture. Albion never dies. This week, U is for United Kingdom. And why not? Lots of people did suggest Union Jack, but the Union Jack is rarely creation of the Act of the Union, and I thought before I explain the Act of the Union, I should explain something about the kingdoms which made it. This is really a back to basics episode, because as I travel around the world, I come across people who've heard of England and the UK and Scotland and Ireland, but they generally don't know how it all clunks together. Which bit is which on this sceptred isle? This sceptred isle is, of course, the beginning of that wonderful speech by John of Gaunt in Shakespeare's Richard II. There are many, many divisions within these islands, and, it causes a huge amount of confusion to people outside the British Isles, which makes sense, but it also causes confusion to people who live within it. Being from a place doesn't necessarily make you an expert on it, in the same way that, you know, the language that you're born and brought up speaking isn't always the language you're best able to explain, because the rules are just the rules, you say it because you say it. And equally, if you live in a place, well, it's just normal, it's just the way it is. I think it can be interesting when you look at other languages and how they describe where I'm living right now. So we say Great Britain, and Doctor Who has the joke that there's no Great Germany, there's no Great France, only Britain is great. But it's worth checking in other languages. Do they call us great? Well, in France, we live on Grande Britannique, in Turkish, Britannia, although you don't hear that too often. It's normally just Inglaterra, although much more commonly just hear Londra. So even though I don't live very close to London, I live hundreds of miles away and actually have very rarely been there. I think I've been there more in the last year than all of the rest of my life put together, just visiting friends, as you may have seen on my social media, but I just pop in there, take a million photos and then post them like over the next few months. But no, I've very little to do with London, and yet Turks will always ask me, what's it like living in London? Don't know. I guess it's like if you're from California, what's it like living in New York? But anyway, these are the terms for other people who aren't desperately invested for these islands. In Chinese, of course, you can say Great Britain, Da Bu Li Dian, but much, much, much more often you'll hear Yingguo, Brave Land. Of course they call us Brave Land. Very fitting. Although they probably call us that because it just sounds similar. America is Meiguo, Beautiful Land. But again, it's what fits. In the Facebook group Britain People, Places and Pastimes, where I often share these episodes and ask for input, I've often seen people write, Great Britain used to be great, but it's not anymore, which I think misunderstands why we're calling it great. Of course, I am in Great Britain because I'm on the biggest island of around 7,000 islands which make up the British Isles. Around 7,000, of course it depends on your exact definition of an island. This definition doesn't include things that are generally hidden by tides once or twice a day, but they're bigger than rocks. they're things you can legitimately land upon and walk about on. So around 7,000, again, estimates do vary. Not all of them are inhabited, of course, but I'm having a little look at the islands and the constituent bits. Of course, the biggest island is the one on which you have England, Scotland and Wales, although each of them possess their own islands. Then, of course, you have Northern Ireland on the Island of Ireland, which also has many, many islands. And I will touch upon the Scottish islands like the Inner and Outer Hebrides, the Shetland Islands and the Orkneys, down south the Channel Islands, and, as I say, in the Irish Sea, the great big one, the Isle of Man. So we have a whole collection of islands that all make up the British Isles. And I'll include the Island of Ireland there. It has become, I'd say political, because people confuse the British Isles with the United Kingdom, but of course the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland are those that are part of the Union, the Act of the Union, and remain part of the Act of the Union. So it is the nation state, or state of several nations uniting together. Oh gosh, this does get complicated. Maybe I should just go through it bit by bit. I'll start with the obvious, the senior, England. England, on the big island, Great Britain, was formed by Alfred the Great, who was the King of Wessex, became king in 871. Now, Wessex is largely the Midlands of England, roughly, but he was able to unite the different Anglo-Saxon tribes, the people who spoke English. He united them in order to fight the Vikings. This had been done before, several times. Kings would often unite the kingdoms around them, get rid of that external threat, and they'd just go back to life as it had been before the threat. Alfred the Great was great because he was truly able to unite them, order them, organise them, and create institutions that would live long after he had passed away. He passed away in 899 AD, but the institutions that he created carried on, including the institution that is England, and the Royal Navy. Although this is much debated by academics, but I think traditionally we've seen him as the man who founded the Royal Navy. Previous kings who united other kings did have navies which they put together, and again they disbanded very rapidly. The Royal Navy was a standing navy that he was able to create. Again, any medievalists are welcome to get in touch with me and we can talk about this. But he united what is largely the Midlands and the south of England. The north, of course, was under Dane law. It was ruled by the Vikings. And it's really interesting whenever you hear these debates about the north-south divide in England. What was under the Danes is largely considered the north, and what was governed by Alfred the Great is largely what we consider the south. One of the interesting results of this is that there are cities geographically further north than a neighbour that we might commonly think of as north, and yet that northern neighbour is actually considered southern by many, and often it just does match on to, the Dane law. Anyway, that's really the formation of England, unifying all these kind of Germanic settlers who displaced the Romanized Britons, uniting them against that threat of the Vikings. So we end up with this kind of interesting little state still going today called England. Of course, we don't really have the Danes anymore because the English were able to slowly erase them, slowly able to push them out, or rather erase their rule and fold it into England. So then we ended up with a border between England and Scotland. And Scotland's an interesting one. It's very, very famous throughout the world. Everywhere I've been, even in very remote parts of China, people have heard of Scotland. It has immense cultural clout for a place that is small and very, very, very sparsely populated in places. It just seems a fashionable place, and it comes in and out of fashion, whether in the kind of the Victorians had their biscuit tin view of Scotland and their craze for kilts and clan tartans, which were kind of a Victorian creation. I mean, obviously, people from a place would naturally make clothes in a traditional way, but the idea of this kind of formalised genealogy of tartan, very, very much a 19th century thing. More recently, I guess in the 90s, you had this craze for Scottish filmmaking, Trainspotting, if you're interested in that, which made Ewan McGregor a bit of a star. Mrs. Brown, with Judi Dench and Billy Connolly, and even 1999's The World Is Not Enough, the Bond film, which kind of copied Mrs. Brown and a few other films with their kind of their warm honey filters, and Monarch of the Glen, which came later, 2005. It was a TV show which had a very kind of warm glow every time you looked at Scotland, a very honeyed filter. Of course, much of Harry Potter, the outdoor scenes, gets filmed in Scotland, but the landscape grows kind of darker and darker as the films progress, in line, of course, with the stories as the main characters mature, but it also kind of, I feel, reaches an apogee with the James Bond film Skyfall 2012, where you see this bleak landscape with glens formed by glaciers in the Ice Age. I do love that line when Bond says, we're going somewhere they don't have the advantage, we're going back in time. And it's Scotland. I'm not sure how the series got away with that. Maybe because it's trumped by the later line, Welcome to Scotland, which in context is a pretty cool line. Anyway, it's a very cinematic place. I've been able, not even Googling anything, just thinking, I've been able to come up with a fair few Scottish films. There is a question. Does Hollywood know that Wales exists? I can't think of a Welsh film apart from the British film, Zulu. And yet it's, is full of culture and, of course, has its own language, Welsh, the oldest unchanged language in Europe. And, of course, what they have given us are wonderful, wonderful singers such as Dame Shirley Bassey and Tom Jones. So they've made quite their contribution to our cultural landscape. And of course, Wales is famous for its mines, its singing, its unusual language. It's fair to say it was some inspiration for J.R.R. Tolkien when he was creating his race of dwarfs in The Lord of the Rings. And so their culture maybe gets fitted into cinematic history a bit. Although I think in the movie, Gimli has more of a Scottish accent than a lilting Welsh accent. Of course, Wales may be famous around the world, more of a thing that that someone is prince of or princess of. That is, of course, because Edward I promised all the Welsh princes that he'd choose a prince for them who spoke not a word of English, and gave them his infant son, later known as the Black Prince, to be their ruler. And it became the tradition that the heir apparent to the English throne is the Prince of Wales. It's where they cut their teeth. Of course, Henry V, one of the more famous medieval kings, really did cut his teeth in immense, interesting battles in Wales, and of course got a scar on his face in reality, which you very rarely see depicted in fiction. Anyway, I shall move on from that, Wales being a very, very beautiful place, but I have to fit in all the kingdoms, and it makes sense to touch on Ireland, Northern Ireland. I haven't touched on it as much in this podcast as I would like, and I have had people asking me about Ireland and Northern Ireland, so, well, why not include it here? Ireland is, of course, the second biggest island in the British Isles, so Great Britain is the big one. We have England, Scotland and Wales. Ireland is the big one next to it, where, of course, you have the patron saint, St. Patrick, a Romanized Briton who was captured and sold into slavery by Irish raiders, and who was ultimately able to escape and went back there in order to convert them to, well, better ways, Christian ways. Ireland and what we consider now England, because, of course, at the time of St. Patrick, there was no England. Alfred hadn't invented it yet. But this Great Britain and Ireland have had a long, long history. Anglo-Saxon princes, of course, after the Norman conquest, fled to Ireland to escape their persecution, and the Normans followed hot on their heels. The Normans conquered England in 1066 and naturally spread, but many of the Norman knights, frankly, dissatisfied with what they got. They felt they deserved more. They put their lives on the line and felt that this little place, England, really wasn't enough for them, especially when the best lands were given to the king and his brothers. So some of them marched into Wales, as you have the Welsh marches, and in Ireland they settled a place which became known as the Pale. Of course, the Palisade is the original name. It gets shortened to the Pale, which becomes known as Dublin, in the local language, of course. And Pale has entered the English language. I think in Apocalypse Now you have the great use of it, when they're describing, the US Army is describing Marlon Brando's rogue colonel, Colonel Kurtz. They say, he's out there, totally beyond the pale of any acceptable human conduct. Beyond the pale. It's a literal thing. It is the fence around old Dublin. And those who lived beyond it, well, barbarians. And those who lived within it, hopefully were civilised, although in time sheep grew like their shepherd, and shepherd like their sheep, and became quite the worry to the Normans. And of course, in the English Civil War, you have the role of the Irish who were coming into England as mercenaries, and so you have the Battle of Bristol as an intense fight, because Bristol could be used as a port by the king. The port faces Ireland, so it could have been used to bring in Irish mercenaries, so therefore the parliamentary forces, no taxation without representation, they were battling to keep Bristol. I mentioned in the O is for Oliver Cromwell episode, his most famous barbarous act in Ireland, the massacre at Drogheda in 1649, the forces he slaughtered were both English and Irish, again, being a continuation of the Civil War. It's hard not to talk about this without talking about the battles, because that's so often what's recorded. They're the sparks in history where heads are butted. But of course, cooperation is the majority of the history in interesting ways. I mean, much of the 19th century, British politics was dominated by the topic Home Rule for Ireland, Gladstone's 1886 bill split the parties at Westminster in much the same way that Brexit split political parties today, and perhaps to an even greater extent. People often complain politics is so divided today. I must say I'd much rather live with Brexit than live with, well, Gladstone's party-splitting bill, or indeed with the Civil War of the 17th century. But I find that really interesting. That has been a real thread throughout English history, and indeed because it ties into Welsh nationalism, Scots nationalism, and if I talk about, you know, say the Oxford history of England, actually encompasses Ireland and Wales and Scotland, because these terms have fluctuated throughout history. We've also used it in the same way that Alfred the Great does, which is people who speak English are English. Indeed, the American colonialists describe themselves as English and refer to, you know, our brethren in England. So it has been a very wide term, as well as becoming increasingly narrowly defined. Anyway, I say it's hard to talk about Ireland without talking about that, and Northern Ireland and the Protestant and Catholic communities who haven't always gotten along. And yet, the contribution to arts and culture, it packs an even bigger punch. Of course, movie stars like Liam Neeson, who has recently been talking about how he did not become James Bond because the lady in his life told him not to. Oh, kissing all those other girls. And of course, Kenneth Branagh, who Rowan Atkinson has said, that man's done more for Shakespeare than Shakespeare ever did. And, of course, lately has gotten into directing films like Thor. He did this comic book movie. I was quite surprised at why he did it, but it seemed to be a fantastic career move. It demonstrated how well he could handle really massive budgets. I'm very glad always to see him in a Christopher Nolan film, and I've always thought, oh, if only Christopher Nolan did a Bond film, then Kenneth Branagh would be the perfect M, if not Ralph Fiennes, Ralph Fiennes. Of course, in sporting history, Northern Ireland will always have had the greatest football player in British history, which is George Best, literally in the man's name, and he is eminently quotable. George Best, who once said, "I spent a lot of money on booze, birds and fast cars. The rest, I just squandered." And also said, "I used to go missing a lot. Miss Canada, Miss United Kingdom, Miss World." He also famously said, "I've stopped drinking, but only while I'm asleep." And rebutted some of his critics by saying, "People always say I shouldn't be burning the candle at both ends. Maybe they haven't got a big enough candle." And, finally, I just can't resist one more quote from George Best. "I might go to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I think it would be difficult for me to remain anonymous." Great football player from the 60s. And, of course, we can go back further. C.S. Lewis, a Protestant from Northern Ireland, whose arguments with a Catholic English J.R. Tolkien became legendary. There are many books worth reading about that. I think Mere Christianity would be my favourite, but there are a fair few others. So, those are the big ones. England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, of course, including Ireland. What else is there to talk about? Well, we have the Scottish Islands, and there are hundreds and hundreds of them. Just putting them into collections, we have the Inner and Outer Hebrides, the Inner Hebrides and the Outer Hebrides being many collections of Hebrides Islands, and I've been in and around them when I was navigating a little Royal Navy coastal patrol ship, because it is a very, very, very good place to learn navigation, because it's very tricky conditions, but it is also one of the most beautiful places I've ever been. The weather is striking. I've heard some Scots say dreich and some Scots say dreich. And what that means is when you get multiple weather patterns at once. So I remember standing on the flying deck of a ship, and you're exposed to the elements, and I had rain, I had hail, I had sunshine, I had warm and cold air. I had everything all at once. It felt as if I was on a movie set with people throwing buckets of different weather at me. And it's simply because these are the islands that face into the North Atlantic, and they break up weather patterns in weird and interesting ways. And of course there are settled populations on them, and of humans and golden eagles, and they are very, very, very beautiful to see as they skim along the surface. I couldn't resist doing a bit of research, of course, rather than just going off my own happy memories. I looked at the Hebrides tourism website, one of them, the Isle of Barra, Which is a bit too wee and rocky for a standard airport, says a tourist ministry. But then again, who wants standard? Port Adair Barra is a Hebridean transport hub and the only one in the world where scheduled flights use a tidal beach for a runway. That's why landing and taking off here is such an iconic, beautiful and surreal experience. Barra to a T. I would say yes, iconic, beautiful and surreal very much describes the Scottish islands. I've also been to the Orkney Islands. I stepped ashore. I was one of the few people on the ships to do so, so that I could plug in electricity and water and so on. I didn't spend a huge amount of time wandering around, although I would love to, because it contains some of the oldest and best preserved Neolithic sites in Europe, the heart of Neolithic. Orkney is a designated UNESCO World Heritage Site. Definitely a place for me to pop back to at some point. And then... the Shetland Islands. It's popularly said that the nearest train station is in Norway. I think Billy Connolly said, isn't it the nearest tree in Norway as well? And got some kind of interesting response from his Shetland Island audience. It's far away on maps of the UK. It's normally in a little box, similar to how Hawaii and Alaska are shown on US maps. And the Shetland Islands, there's more than 100 of them, although only 15 are permanently inhabited by a total of about 23,000 people, one of whom, I believe, listens to this podcast from Shetland with Love. Hello! Most of them live on the biggest island, which, brilliantly to my mind, is known as Mainland. So yes, I had a quick Google actually before this episode of, you know, British Isles, and I was curious to see Great Britain listed on one bit and Mainland listed on another bit. I thought, oh, that's funny, Google's put them twice, it hasn't really realised they're the same place. And then I clicked on them and my goodness, no, Mainland in the UK is a lot smaller than Great Britain. Anyway, it's also, Shetlands are of course home to the Shetland pony, who measure between 28 and 42 inches or 107 centimetres high. Small but very, very strong. And something that's worth Googling is Upheli Ah, which is a fire festival held annually in Shetland on the last Tuesday in January. Upheli Ah. So visitors are welcome, as they use, I think, 1,000 torches to set fire to a great wooden ship. But it's very much a local event, so participants must have been a resident in Shetland for 5 years before they can take part in a squad and the procession. However, visitors are warmly welcomed in one of the halls for festivities after the procession, providing they can get their hands on a much sought-after ticket. I must admit, this isn't a festival that I knew a huge amount about. I've just been looking it up for this podcast. The organisation of the Upheli Ah is voluntary, run by a committee of 17 members, with a new member elected every year, and to become Geyser Jarl, the chief geyser, the chief committee member, a member must serve 16 years on the committee. Wow. The pictures of it are spectacular, so even if you don't have this as your recommended rabbit hole, I do suggest Google Image as your I'm not sure if that's even a rabbit hole. That's just a rabbit's blade of grass. Anyway, down south we've got some other islands, so I'll go through the English ones now, the Channel Islands. So when William the Conqueror came over, he was of course living in northern France. That's where Normandy is. Of course, over time, the Normans would lose their French lands. It wasn't the Normans, the Plantagenets would lose bits, and so on, so on, so on. Successive bits of the family would lose different bits. But anyway, the Channel Islands are the bits that remain. They are very, very, very close to France, rather than England, and therefore become the only bit of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, etc., 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 to be occupied by the Germans during World War II, which, by an odd result, means that they are the only British people who were asked to drive on the right-hand side of the road. Barbaric. Anyway, the Channel Islands consist of the Bailiwick of Jersey, which is the largest of the islands, with a population just over 100,000 people. And it's also one of the world's largest offshore financial centres. Keeps it in good stead. And they have their own currency, still using the £1 note. Then you have Guernsey, consisting of, Guernsey, Old Sark and Herm. I don't think I've ever met anyone from any of those. The populations are too small. A friend of mine recently met someone from Sark, so he was pretty surprised. It's a very small island, I think a few hundred families. And then, of course, you've got the Isle of Wight. The Isle of Wight, famously, if you want to know what the Isle of Wight looked like 50 years ago, just go today. Life there is very much as it always was. Ah, I couldn't resist telling that joke to a fellow I knew from the Isle of Wight. I didn't know him very well, I just couldn't resist, and he was like, ah, so you have been. Yes. Like all these little islands, they are beautiful. And there's one that I haven't been to but would like to go to, which is the Isle of Man, a self-governing crown dependency in the Irish Sea between Great Britain and Ireland. So the head of state is, of course, Charles III, so he's the Lord of Man. It's represented by Lieutenant Governor. The United Kingdom is responsible for the island's military defences and represents it abroad and so on, but it has its own parliament. Older than the Parliament, at Westminster, the Tynwald on the Isle of Man is claimed to have been in continuous existence since the year 979 or earlier, which would make it the oldest continuously sitting governing body in the world. There have been no breaks, which is what sets it apart from all the others that claim to be old or as old. A couple of claim to be older, but it's the only one that's been continuously sitting and governing. The voting age on the island is 16, so they get to vote a little bit before the rest of us, that little population of 84,000 people. They used to have some really good film tax breaks, so there was a sudden spike in TV shows filming there. And like the Channel Islands, they've got their own currency, the Manx pound, which looks quite different from those used in Great Britain. Although I should say, yes, the English have our own currency, there's Scottish money, Northern Ireland has its own notes, I think Wales is the one that doesn't. So, a Back to Basics episode, as I describe, just a few of the 7,000 islands that make up the British Isles and the United Kingdom are those that, you know, are under King Charles III, and I hope that helps clarify things for those who live abroad. And if you're living here, I hope you just enjoyed my telling of it. And let me know if there's something you thought wasn't right, because some of this does get debated. I shall end as I started with that wonderful speech from Shakespeare. This royal throne of kings, this sceptred isle, this earth of majesty, this seat of Mars, this other Eden, demi-paradise, this fortress built by nature for herself, against infection and the hand of war. This happy breed of men, this little world, this precious stone set in the silver sea, which serves it in the office of a wall, or as a moat defensive to a house against the envy of less happier lands. My name is Thomas. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of British Culture, Albion Never Dies.